I've just started recording. Let me introduce today's speaker and the topic. We're lucky to have Katie Witkiewicz, who's a professor of psychology and a scientist at the Center on Alcoholism, Substance Abuse, and Addictions at the University of New Mexico. She's a licensed clinical psychologist. She's been very involved in the development of mindfulness-based interventions for substance use disorders since back in 2002. She's been very involved in empirical studies on mindfulness and prediction of relapse following treatment and mechanisms of change following mindfulness-based interventions. So we're really thrilled. Dr. Witkiewicz is the past president of SOAP, and she seems to have survived her tenure. And with no further ado, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And just a quick question. So this is my first clinical conference call. So do I just keep rambling on, and then if someone wants to interrupt me, they'll interrupt me?
You can do it either way. I would advise you to check in every once in a while, because every once in a while somebody drops out, and we had one speaker who kept talking even though nobody else was on the call.
Okay.
Very embarrassing. To all concerned, but you could set it up either way, questions along the way, or you could stop every once in a while for questions either way.
Okay, that sounds great. Well, feel free, anyone on the call, to just interrupt me at any time. I'm really used to that. I teach undergrads, so feel free. And did people get the PowerPoint? I sent a PowerPoint around.
Yeah.
Okay. If anyone didn't get it, you could email me right now at Dr. Mark Schenker at Gmail, DrMarkSchenker at Gmail, and I can shoot it right out to you.
Great. Thank you, Mark. And I'll try to not rely too much on it in case people don't have it. And thanks for the introduction and the invitation to talk about mindfulness-based interventions. It's really exciting to see this come into the mainstream more. Like Mark said, I've been working in this area since 2002. And when we first started doing mindfulness-based work, we really didn't get much of an audience for reasons that mindfulness was not as accepted back then. We had a hard time getting grants funded. We had a hard time getting papers acknowledged by journals. It was considered third wave and froofy, and now we've I think really established that it's a science based approach. And all of you being on the call kind of validates that it does have merit and interest, hold interest. So I'm really excited to talk with you. So three main aims today for this clinical teleconference, to talk about the theoretical and empirical foundations underlying a mindfulness-based approach to treating substance use disorders. I'll talk about some of the key practices and adaptations and some of the challenges of mindfulness practices for use with alcohol and drug use disorders. And I'll also talk about how we implement mindfulness-based practices into clinical treatment and some basic principles for conducting intervention research, and hopefully have time for lots of questions and discussion as well and as we go. So we're right around New Year's resolution time. I won't ask how many of you have made New Year's resolutions. I can tell you from the data that probably you made the same one as you made last year if you did make one, which tells you a lot about the success people have with New Year's resolutions.
Yeah, a speaker on this. You want to go get your phone and plug it in here? The speaker doesn't work well on this.
Can I ask you to please press your... Can I ask, did I press the right button? Can you please press your mute button? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. So about 65% of people make the same New Year's resolution every year. So that tells us something about how hard it is to change behavior, and how quitting something is, and this is a famous Alan Marlett quote for those of you who knew Alan. He was my mentor and really guided a lot of this work and certainly my thinking on it. And he once said, quitting is not nearly as difficult as staying quit. And that really is the heart of the matter and where this intervention, I think, has the best utility. Because relapse is a major issue in the treatment of addiction, as many of you probably know, having treated addiction. And, you know, there's various ways to define relapse. We often think of it as return to substance use or return to problematic substance use. There's varying definitions. I like to think of it more about functioning, so not so much how much people are using, but are they functioning? Are they having a good quality of life or not? And generally, you know, the majority of people will return to some level of use, but people are more successful when we define relapse as kind of a return to poor functioning and quality of life. So regardless of how you define it, we've simplified the relapse cycle to three basic things that kind of happen. And we've simplified this over the years, having worked with patients and really talking with them about what caused the relapse or what caused the use. And it seems like generally it starts with some sort of, and this is in people who really want to control their some behavior. There's some sort of trigger, and that can be internal or external. And oftentimes, whatever that trigger is, can result in discomfort in wanting. Either of those two things, either kind of discomfort, not wanting what's happening, or wanting to feel differently, wanting to be accepted, wanting to be not lonely. Interestingly, that part, I think one thing we highlight a lot in this treatment is that the discomfort or wanting part is often a really, really wholesome basic need, right? Like if you're lonely, it's a basic need to not want to feel lonely and to want to be accepted and to want to feel comforted. Or if you're feeling distressed or depressed or anxious, it's a wholesome need to not want that, right? Like this a lot of this starts in a place that's actually kind of a basic human need, wholesome place. But what can happen is that can circle and cycle into kind of a really palpable craving, and that craving can be different for different people, but there's this kind of real obsessive wanting or seeking relief or craving or pleasure. And all of that then kind of spirals into use of a substance or overuse of a substance if you have a moderate drinking goal or a moderate use goal. And then that just kind of creates this relapse cycle where you're just not feeling good and then you use more and then you're not feeling good. So that's kind of the process we're trying to interrupt. And so there's many places to interrupt that process, it turns out. You know, we can raise awareness of the trigger. So maybe that becomes less triggering. We can change your reaction to the trigger, maybe stopping the process really early on. We can teach people how to sit with discomfort. And so raising awareness of discomfort and being okay with discomfort. We can also change reaction to discomfort so you don't have to have in response to the discomfort. And then with craving, we can raise awareness of craving and can you sit with craving? Can we learn how to sit with craving without using? And then we can change the reaction to the craving as well. We can do another activity instead of using. And then when we use, if you get it so far along in the process that you actually use a substance, can we raise awareness of that? Can we stop the process there? Can you be okay with using once or twice or even several, you know, times, but not fall back into the cycle? So that's kind of the basic model that we're working from. I'm going to pause there and see if there's any questions or comments.
Sounds great. Keep going.
Okay.
Yeah, well, thank you. Thank you for setting it up, setting up kind of that foundation. It's helpful.
I love this slide. I love these slides, and I would love to be able to use them with clients.
Yes, for sure. And so they're going to be available on the SOAP website, by the way. I will upload them as soon as I'm done with this call. I had the intention of doing it before the call, but I didn't get to it.
Well, Mark did it, so we've got them.
You got them. Okay, great.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, what's fun is this treatment is actually quite simple because all of these points of intervention, you know, raising awareness of the trigger, changing reaction to the trigger, raising awareness of discomfort, all of these points of intervention, we're gonna use one skill. So CBT, you've got this whole laundry list of skills, right? And that's great, and that works for a lot of people. But for a lot of people, it's hard to keep track, and when do you use which skill and when? And for all of this, it's one skill, and that's mindfulness. And so what I'm going to ask us to do, this might be a first for the clinical teleconferences, is to actually take a moment to practice. We're going to do an experiential clinical teleconference. I've never tried this before, so it might bomb, but why not try? So if you're in a place where you can disengage from whatever else you're doing, so if you're also checking email or also writing a note or whatever you're doing, if you could disengage from that just for a moment, and I don't know that you're not disengaging, right? I can't see anyone, but if you could just sit in an upright position for a moment, and just notice the grounding sensations of whatever position you're in. Maybe you're standing or sitting. Just notice the sensations of being against the seat or feet on the floor. Just taking a moment to kind of feel the groundedness of being in this place. Now taking just another moment to check in with your breathing. You don't have to change it in any way. Just, what is it? Is it fast? Is it slow? Did you know that you were breathing? You just notice my breathing's very fast. What is the breath like right now? See if you can just follow for a couple of seconds now an in-breath and an out-breath. Trying to stay with the sensations of breathing. Okay. So that was a mini mindfulness practice. The beautiful thing about mindfulness is that you don't have to be in a yoga studio on a cushion with flowing robes. You can be in the TSA security line. Trust me, that's where I practice it most. You can be in your office chair and just take a brief moment, a look away from the computer screen. You can be in between clients, and you don't need to set up a specific time or place. You can do it anywhere, everywhere, all the time. On my way into work, I was practicing at all the stoplights. We encourage the practice of mindfulness whenever you can, as often as you can, even if it's that brief of a practice. And the idea is to just bring your attention inward to the present moment. And what happens always is your attention will wander. That's what we do. That's what our mind does. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's natural. That's what happens. But we can bring our attention back again and again and again. And we can just keep doing that without judgment. Oh, yeah, there it went off again. I went into my to-do list or my, you know, plans for the day or my worries, the worry of the day, top 10 worries of the day. Whatever you go into, we can just keep coming back. And that's the goal. If your attention wanders 100 times, simply bring it back 100 times. So that's the basic practice. Meditation's been associated with all sorts of good things. I used to have to include a slide on what meditation is good for because it wasn't everywhere in the media, and it wasn't on Time magazine with the beautiful woman on the top of the mountain with the yellow, white flowy robes. But now it's everywhere, so now most people have a general sense that this is probably a good-for-you kind of thing, kind of like exercise and eating well. Meditation practice is associated with all sorts of good things, increased intentional control, improved physical health. There's a great study on immune function. We're coming up on cold and flu season, and if you want to not get sick, sit on a cushion for a bit, because there was a great study showing it actually improves your immune response, enhanced self-awareness, greater self-regulation, and reductions in stress and perceived stress. It actually changes the brain as well. There's really good studies showing even brief meditation periods and brief meditation courses can change how your brain functions. So we thought about using this for addiction a long time ago. Alan Marlett thought about it in the 70s. And he tried, actually. There's a couple of old studies. I'm happy to share them with you if you want, from the late 70s, looking at meditation for alcohol use. But then he left it. He was told to focus on more serious research. I used air quotes there. You couldn't see me, but I used air quotes. And so he left it for quite some time and then finally came back to it. But the idea with mindfulness is to, for addiction, is to bring greater awareness to the present moment, bring greater awareness of triggers and responses to triggers, and to bring awareness to acceptance of whatever's happening right now, rather than trying to get a fix and get out of what's right now. And to do so non-judgmentally, so to be able to detach from all the shame and guilt and all the things you've done wrong, and all, you know, we have, all of our patients have so much shame and guilt, and, you know, a lot of them have had horrible lives and done horrible things, and that's, of course they are, you know, so using a bit of a framework of you're doing the best you can, a DBT framework of you're doing the best you can for right now, but I want you to be right now, even though right now kind of sucks and it hurts and it's depressing and it's, you're anxious and you're tired and you're restless and all of those things. Just be with them. That's what we're trying to do. So, moving in, unless there, I'll pause there quickly and then I'll move into the treatment. Any questions?
This is Christina from Boston. I just want to say thank you for doing the mindfulness exercise. I really liked how you made the point that it can be done anywhere. I thought you did that really well.
Thank you. Yeah, I needed it. I often do. Yeah, it's really, and that's something we encourage with our patients, especially because, you know, the chaotic lives of addiction that many of you know, and a lot of them have this perception that they could never do meditation because they don't have, you know, they don't have a meditation room in their house, and they don't have time to go to a sangha, and they don't have time to go to a yoga studio. And our point is no. You do it wherever you can, you know. Washing dishes, taking a shower, doing the things you have to do anyways, can you make it a mindfulness practice? And that's something we really try to work on.
Have you found a population?
Go ahead.
Have you found a population that has really struggled with being able to sit still and, you know, sort of having to do a kind of a transition introduction or preparation for that?
Yeah, all of our populations. But we start slow. We build to longer practices. And we have adapted. My colleague Sarah Bowen's done work with juvenile justice, and you know, young kids in juvenile justice have a really hard time, and so we shorten the practices. We do more. Another thing that's helpful with people who have trouble sitting still is mindful movement. So, so you don't have to be still. You know, you can be. We do this great little exercise where you're just tapping your body all over, like standing and tapping your body, and then pausing and noticing the sensations in the body after tapping. Really powerful use of what's happening in the body, the bodily sensations.
That's great.
I don't know if this is helpful, but also I think telling people that it does take practice and they may not feel the effects at first, but they keep trying, I think that might also encourage people to stick with it.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's something we say a lot. We also really, you know, a lot of people have this mindset that it's going to help them relax and that it's going to, you know, make them calm. And we really try to disabuse that notion from day one. And so, you know, we'll offer as part of, I'll get to what inquiry is, but as part of the inquiry process, which is the key ingredient, key active therapeutic process, we really focus on, okay, so this time you noticed relaxation. You know, I didn't really notice that. My heart was really racing throughout that practice. So we'll self-disclose our own experience as a way of providing the example that you can have all sorts of experiences and it's not always good. And especially, we want to stay with the not good. That's actually what we really want. I love it when clients really struggle with this, because that's exactly what we want. We want that struggle, and it's almost like exposure to difficult. Mm-hmm. We want that. So, yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm going to jump into, you know, there's numerous mindfulness-based treatments for addiction, and all of them are similar and great and wonderful. I'm going to focus on the one that I helped develop, which is mindfulness-based relapse prevention. But there's mm-hmm. many other ones, including Sam Himmelstein's developed a specific mindfulness-based substance use treatment for adolescents. Davis and Brewer have both developed treatments for smoking. There's also David Wetter's mindfulness-based addiction treatment, which is primarily for smoking. And then Eric Garland's developed a whole group of interventions called mindfulness-oriented recovery enhancement that has great data, too. And the programs are different in different, you know, have different ways of delivering the content. I think they're all really similar in what we've discussed up till now, as far as really trying to bring attention and awareness to the present moment via mindfulness practices. But again, for the rest of the call, I'm going to highlight some of our work with mindfulness-based relapse prevention. It is a manualized treatment, and I've got some resources at the end. We combined mindfulness practices from the mindfulness-based stress reduction and mindfulness-based cognitive therapy programs, and we combined them with some relapse prevention skills training. So the idea is to bring in both formal mindfulness meditation and relapse prevention. But the relapse prevention is very different from CBT-based, skills-based relapse prevention. It's more around the mindfulness components, so they're more integrated than just kind of, okay, now we're doing relapse prevention. Like, it's much more integrated than that, where instead of, you know, kind of doing relapse chains in a relapse prevention context, we're doing relapse chains in the context of, okay, and what did you notice in the body then? What happened? What did you notice in your mind then? And so we're really bringing, it's really about the mindfulness practices, but the focus is on, like, the relapse triggers. The format has typically been tested as aftercare or post-stabilization. So the idea is this would be done primarily with people who have had some level of stabilization. That's how we've tested it. I'm currently doing a trial as a fully outpatient group, so people who are just initially seeking treatment. I'll let you know how that goes. but it's going well, I can say that. We're also using it in a residential setting. It's group format. People have done it individually, and so we can talk more about that, about some of the different adaptations for individual treatment. We do it as group, though, and it's been tested as group with 8 weekly 2-hour sessions and daily home practices, so daily home practice assignments for the meditations. The manual, which you can buy on Amazon, it's quite affordable, and it's very step-by-step, incorporates both formal mindfulness practices, so breath meditation, body scan, walking meditation, mindful movement. We have a lovely mountain meditation and loving kindness meditation. We've also incorporated a forgiveness practice, which is just really hitting home a lot for our patients. And then it also has these informal practices, so mindfulness and daily living, the sober breathing space, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and urge surfing. And many people are familiar with urge surfing. It's been around for a while because it was in the original relapse prevention book, and we've just expanded on it in this program. And then there is some kind of formal relapse prevention coping skills training, too, so worksheets on identifying triggers, that sort of thing. We've done 3 randomized clinical trials now. I'm going to breeze through the data piece because these are all published. You can read them, and I want to get more to the delivering this and then answering questions about how to do this. But I will talk about the 3 randomized clinical trials a little bit. They all three of them had active control conditions. So we have tested the mindfulness-based relapse prevention program versus our own relapse prevention, and as well as against a treatment-as-usual control group. And this was a community-based mental health program. They had psychoeducation, relapse prevention, 12-step groups, assertiveness training, communication skills, time management, all sorts of kind of general group. If you can imagine a traditional addiction treatment facility and all the groups they offer there, that's what the treatment as usual was. So we've done, again, these three different clinical trials, randomized clinical trials, with diverse populations. And so for those of you looking at the slides, you know, we've worked with people who are polysubstance users and a mix of substance use. Our current trial is with just solely alcohol use disorder patients, and it's our first trial actually with just alcohol use disorder patients, and everything is seemingly going well and the same as with these prior trials that have had a mix of substances. Most of these folks are at the severe end of the continuum. They have completed inpatient or intensive outpatient programs, or they're currently in residential treatment, so it's a more severe end of the population. Our findings in all three trials have been that the mindfulness-based program has resulted in greater reductions in drug use in drinking days and better reductions in drug use and heavy drinking than the relapse prevention condition, which was a surprise to us because when we proposed the relapse prevention condition as the kind of second condition, we thought the findings would be equivalent between the mindfulness group and the relapse prevention groups, and that wasn't the case. Mindfulness was actually more effective than relapse prevention for most patients. And, you know, with modest effect sizes, small to medium effect sizes. And for those of you who have the slides, you can look at this next, but I love this dialogue that happened, and we had this in a recording and got permission to share it. So in our female residential program, this was one of our research trials, it was a rolling group. So there would be a kind of experienced people in there with new people coming in. And so a new person coming in said, "What's the difference between this mindful stuff and normal treatment?" And the experienced person who'd been in the group for quite some time said, "Listen, we're all missing something in our souls, and we tried filling that missing place up with a bunch of drugs, and it didn't work. Mindfulness and MBRP helped me look at that empty place for the first time. MBRP gave me the tools to do that, and then tools to figure out how I could fill up the missing place by taking care of myself." Ah, verklempt. I always get verklempt reading that. I shouldn't have it in talks. So a really beautiful kind of description from someone from lived experience of what we're trying to do here, which is really change the game altogether. We're not trying to avoid people, places, and things. We're not trying to layer on more things that someone needs to think about in their life. We're trying to actually change their way of being with the world altogether, and give them something to really fill the void that drugs provided. And the reality is, and this quote really does a nice job of saying it, is that drugs serve a purpose for people for a really long time. It provides immediate relief when you're really distressed. And so we're saying, okay, we're going to look at that distress and see if you can sit with it. And then it gives them something to deal with the distress, to work with the distress, rather than just avoid and try to push it away. So speaking of that, our mechanisms that we're really targeting with this treatment is to try to not get rid of craving or get rid of negative affect or get rid of stress. Let's face it, we can't get rid of that stuff, right? You know, turn on the news. You can't get rid of it. You can't get rid of negative affect and stress these days. You know, go drive down the street and you're in traffic, and go to the, you know, walk down the street and there's people around, and anyways, that you can't get rid of stress. But what if we could change your reaction to it? And that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to increase awareness, to decrease autopilot, to increase kindness to self and others, to increase, again, self-compassion and decrease reactivity. We're not trying to change craving, but we do find that people in MBRP report lower craving over time. And most interestingly, and this will be the last, I think the last data slide, for those of you looking at the slides, slide 19, what we have found is that people in the control group, treatment as usual control, when they experienced depression, as their depression symptoms went up, their drinking and drug use went up. And that's what we, you know, that's kind of the known association, negative affect relief is drinking or drug use. And in the MBRP group, we didn't see that association. So in MBRP, when people experienced depression, they weren't drinking or using drugs. And that's really what the core of what we're getting at. So I'll pause there after the last data slide and see if there's any questions about the data or the research at all. Okay, you guys want to hear about how to do it, huh? Enough data. All right, well, let me just start by talking about some of the intentions. And I've already said a lot of this, but I'm going to repeat it in a more formal way. The first intention of mindfulness-based treatments is to raise awareness and to train attention. And so mindfulness is a skill for training attention, right? When we're sitting with our breath and our mind wanders, we're learning how to notice the mind wandering and bring the attention back to the breath. And so by doing that, by constantly sitting in formal practice and training the breath, or even just taking time at the stoplight to train the attention, to bring the attention inward, we're training our awareness, we're increasing our awareness. And doing so, the idea is that doing so will help people make better daily decisions that might increase risk. So decrease risk, actually, daily decisions that would decrease risk, that they would raise awareness to both the internal and environmental triggers, that they'll be more aware of seemingly automatic reactions, and recognize and disengage from some of those triggers and the craving. And one of the exercises we use throughout the program is urge surfing. And due to time, I won't go through this now, but there's great clips online. I'll have a website at the end to refer you to for kind of scripts of how to lead this. But what we do in session is we actually have people imagine a triggering scenario in the session. So we do in vivo exercises where we have someone imagine the triggering situation, and then we bring attention to that. And it can be really hard, to do these practices in session. People get really triggered. We ask them to pick we always ask people if, 10 is the most triggering thing you've ever experienced, pick a 4. Inevitably, almost everyone picks a 7 or an 8, of course, but we tell them to pick a 4. And then we sit with it, and we use a breath meditation to bring awareness to the breath and notice, okay, what are you noticing now in this triggering situation? And then using kind of a surfing analogy of just letting your attention ride the breath and allowing these urges and these sensations that are overwhelming, allow them in, allow them, and then just notice, and we carry it out until it dissipates, or until it goes down. And so people get to experience in the session, I actually can ride this out. I can ride out this wave, and I can bring awareness to these feelings and not have to fix it, not have to get away from it. And so that's what we're doing with this urge surfing exercise. And a big part of that, though, also is we're training, and we reiterate this throughout the training or throughout the treatment, curiosity about that. What does crying feel like? What does being really upset feel like? What does that feel like in the body? what is that? What does pain feel like? What is the pain like? Where does the pain stop? And having some curiosity about it. What color is the pain? So bringing awareness to discomfort and pain and crying and craving and all the things that we're typically running from. And with a little bit of curiosity and acceptance. And the goal there is to really shift from emotional avoidance to curiosity around these experiences. And again, going back to what I said earlier about how a lot of what triggers craving is often really wholesome basic needs. So, you know, wanting to be accepted, not wanting to be lonely, not wanting to feel anxious and depressed, not wanting to feel alone or a failure, all those things, that's, oh my gosh, how wholesome is that? You know, of course you don't want to feel that way. And is alcohol or drugs making it better? Like, probably not. Like, maybe if I could just be with these things that aren't so great, and recognize that is wholesome, that those basic needs are kind of wholesome, and take some of the shame away of life experience, of our experience. So I'm going to move in right now to our next, one of our shining star, our kind of the exercise everyone loves, and I'll have us practice it right now. So what I'm going to have you do is just stop whatever you're doing. If you're checking email or writing notes, whatever, just stop. And I'm going to practice it too, so I'm doing this with you. And now just observe. Just drop in to the body. Notice the heart beating. What is the feeling of the body right now? Are there any emotions or sensations? And now dropping into breath sensations, and maybe even taking a deep breath if that feels good, or a sigh if that feels good. Just dropping into the breath. And just staying here now and seeing if you can stay with a few breaths. And now expanding back out to our body in the room, things we were doing. And now we can respond from a place of mindfulness. So I'm going to ask a brave soul to chime in, and if they practice that, what we just did, that little mini practice, if you noticed anything and what you noticed. Anyone, go ahead.
I'm in an area where there is a tremendous amount of rain today and low barometric pressure. So as soon as I was really quiet and breathing more fully, I felt fatigue.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me more about that. What did you notice? What did fatigue feel like?
A weight, kind of a heaviness.
Heaviness.
And a sinking.
Yeah. And then what happened?
And then you broke the train of relaxing and mindfulness, and that all dissipated.
And then it dissipated. Yeah. Thank you. And it kind of shows how we can go in and out, right, of noticing things and then letting it go and coming in and out. So that practice, I'm going to move along because I know we're running short. That practice is the sober breathing space. And our clients, we ran data on this, 98% of them say they use this the most and it helps them the most. It's so short. I use it every time I fly, every time I'm in traffic. It's really just a very quick check-in and a way to step out of automatic pilot and to check in. And sometimes, like you noted, sometimes you check in and you realize, oh my gosh, like, wow, I'm really tense or fatigued, or I check in and I'm really, like, my heart is racing. And the idea isn't to make that go away. The idea is to just notice whatever is happening. And in that pause, we hypothesize, is enough to break the autopilot and help people gain some kind of control over their experience and some acceptance and awareness of experience without reaching for a drug. So what we're doing, if you're on the next slide, and if you don't have the slides in front of you, I'll explain it. What we're doing throughout every single practice in this treatment is really drawing a distinction from the direct experience and what we add on to that. And so direct experience is the pain, the fatigue, the heaviness, the sadness, the split-second thought that is an awful thought, and how did I get that thought, but that thought's there. Like, that's the direct experience. And then everything else we add on to that. And those things we add on are often much worse than the direct experience. So to take the example of feeling fatigued and, you know, and then all of a sudden, oh, my God, how am I going to get through the rest of the day? This is just awful. I can't stand my life. I hate this. Why is this happening to me? Like, all of that is so much worse than the initial direct experience, often. Often those stories and reactions and judgments and worries add so much on to the direct experience. What if we could just be with the direct experience and not add all that on? So that brings up kind of the final intention of just having some self-compassion, of being able to reduce some self-judgment and be with the self and know that you're strong and to have that strength from within, the strength of direct experience of this is okay, I'm okay, I can be with this. And I'm going to jump right to the next slide on facilitating mindfulness-based treatments. And this is the inquiry that I was talking about. So what we do in this treatment as a therapist, as a facilitator of the treatment, is we're constantly drawing the distinction between the direct experience and the reactions and stories and judgment. And we do this via a process called inquiry. So the direct experience, we say, is analogous to pain. And the everything we add to it is the suffering. So what, you know, can we just have pain and not suffering? And so we do this by really asking questions. We do the practices, we do the mindfulness practices, and then we say, what was your experience? What happened? And someone might say, oh, I had pain in my left knee, I was really restless, and then I thought, I can't do this. Okay, so tell me about that pain in your left knee. So letting go of story, letting go of the judgment and focusing in what was their direct experience. So you had pain in your left knee and you were restless. Tell me about that. What was that direct experience like? And we're really interested in first kind of noting what did people notice during the exercise? What was the direct experience? And then is that similar or familiar or different from their direct experience elsewhere? And then we often kind of are looking at kind of the distinction between, you know, the direct experience to where people go with it. So going from this was hard as the direct experience and I'm tearful to I can't handle this, I need to escape this. Oh, okay. So you became tearful and had an initial thought, which was the direct experience that this is really hard. But then that turned into all of these other judgments about it. Is that familiar? You know, is that process for you familiar? So looking at individual processes of change. And then asking the bigger question, the kind of $5 million question, how does this relate to craving and relapse and recovery? You know, how does this play out for you? Or before you came into treatment, how did that play out for you? How could that be different going forward? how could you focus in on the awareness? What could you do differently? All right, I'm going to pause. Questions?
Hi, this is George from Keystone Center in Chester,
hi,
PA. Thank you for your presentation of it. Question about the research, if I can.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if what the research says about population of co-occurring disorders, mental health, and substance use. I noticed some of the population you cited were a female offending population of offenders who are female.
Yeah. Yeah, and that population 100% had comorbid mental health disorders. So yeah, this especially works well. We just actually published a paper, I'm happy to share it with anyone who's interested, that showed this treatment works especially well for people with high comorbid symptomatology, so high negative affect symptomatology in particular. We had in that sample with female offenders, about 85% of them had PTSD. We do some adaptations for trauma, so we encourage people with trauma to, you know, keep eyes open if that feels safer. For the body scan, we avoid, you know, we tell them to, you know, if there's a part of the body that you can't focus your awareness, that's okay. You know, you can move to another part of the body. But yeah, so this treatment is particularly effective. In the studies we've done, when we've isolated out people with comorbid symptomatology, it seems to do better, especially better for those folks. Now, we haven't done a study where we've explicitly recruited a comorbid population, but all of our patients pretty much have had some comorbid psychopathology, with the exception of we exclude people with active psychosis.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, great question. Thank you.
Katie, this is Nancy Petrovsky in the Bay Area. I had a follow-up
Nancy.
Question.
Sure.
So with those studies with the comorbid folks, did you look at whether or not they were on medication or whether their medication compliance changed? Because one of the things we find from, like, general health studies where you use mindfulness or relaxation techniques is that compliance around medication and other treatment behaviors changes. It's kind of if they do relaxation, meditation, they're more likely to start to be compliant with other things.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering about, you know, mediating kind of effects. And I wondered if you guys had looked at any of that.
Unfortunately, we haven't tracked the medical record data. That's something I'm definitely interested in doing
mm-hmm.
going forward. And I was just talking with one of the psychiatrists here at UNM about potentially doing a medication trial with mindfulness for that very reason, to see
mm-hmm.
if we can enhance compliance.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll jump to resources and then open it up for more general questions. So there is a manual for this. We have a website, mindfulrp.com, and on that website you can get access to further training opportunities. We also just published a book with Hogreth. The book is called Mindfulness. It's a more general book on how to bring mindfulness practices into treatment. So maybe you don't want to do a full 8-week MBRP program, but you want to bring mindfulness practices and mindfulness intentions into another treatment. And so that's really what this new book is about. It's kind of a background of the intentions of the practices and then some specific examples and how to adapt to specific populations. And if you're a member of APA Division 12, there's a 20% discount, so 20% discount for Division 12 members. I'll add that all the proceeds for that book are going to an Alan Marlatt fund for providing trainings to people at reduced cost. So I'm not making any money off the book. I just want to make that clear as I'm touting it on this call that I'm actually not making any money. All the money is going to either Hogreth or this Alan Marlatt fund that we've set up. So with that, I will thank my collaborators. My last slide, my main collaborator, Sarah Bowen, who really is the heart and soul of the clinical work of this. I've been primarily involved with the research, and Sarah has really done the bulk of the training and continues to do trainings, as well as Neha Chawla. Denise Gower was our therapist on the Women's Center study, and Joel Groh has also been involved with this from the beginning. A lot of research assistants are involved with this work. And, of course, I have to thank Ellen Marlatt, my mentor, who inspired all of this. So I'll stop there, but I'll take plenty of questions. We've adapted this to rolling group. As I said, we've done this with individual clients as well. So I'll take questions.
Hi, this is Diana in Gettysburg. And this is just a wonderful presentation. Thank you so much. I am not primarily a substance abuse. I'm a clinician. I'm primarily, general psychotherapy, and I do use a lot of mindfulness generally in some work. And as I'm going through what you're talking about, and I use a lot of, like, Tara Brach's work, RAIN, as, you know, that same has a lot of those same components. And so right now what I'm really thinking about is a client who is very obese and had done many years of psychodynamic therapy before coming to me and, you know, has a history of child abuse and so on. But she has good insight into those things.
Mm-hmm.
But she has really... the eating disorder is the big issue, and I'm just seeing so much of this that would really, you know, apply to working with that. I'm wondering if your mindfulness book or you know of other resources, you know, that apply this to binge eating to, you know, mindful eating.
Yes, yeah. Actually, Jean Christeller developed a program called MB Eat.
MB Eat,
yeah, mindfulness based, and I can't remember honestly off the top of my head what the EAT stands for, but it's a program specific to eating and particularly for binge eating disorder. She's gotten good data results with binge eating disorder, and part of the practices is mindful eating. So using all the same kind of basic tenets that we talked about today, but with the focus around kind of craving and trigger and urges around eating, and then, kind of training in mindful eating as well. So, yeah, I think it's a great point that it's a transdiagnostic approach, clearly. We've also done this with other kinds of addictions. We've done this with sex addiction, with gambling, and very minor adaptations, really, for each of those, because it's basic stuff. It's basic process. It's all the basic processes that I think underlie a lot of problems in ourselves and in our clients.
So who was the author of MB Eat?
Jean Christeller, K-R-I-S-T-E-L-L-E-R. But I think if you Google MB Eat, it should come up.
Okay, that's wonderful. Thank you.
Yeah,
so,
you're welcome.
All right, how about anger management?
Of course, yes, even better. Even better. That's, yeah.
Have anything specifically, you know, targeted for that?
I mean, we have a lot of anger issues in our clients all the time. And so a lot of the time we're focusing these practices around kind of anger that comes up. So I don't know of someone who's explicitly, I bet it's out there though. I mean, there's mindfulness-based treatment for everything now.
Yeah.
But our program works with, a lot of our people are angry. And so these practices generalize to that emotion.
Yeah, great. Yeah, one piece I just want to express my particular gratitude to you for, and that is really making explicit and talking about the fact that mindfulness is not about relaxation and being calm. That,
right.
Yes, that there may be, and that's very helpful to me. I haven't really done that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that very much.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, no, it's I had to get over that myself initially, and it's really not about that. yeah. Thank you.
This is Mark again. Let me jump in. I know the time is up, although I'm willing to leave the call open for a little while if you have the time, Katie. I want to thank you. It was a wonderful presentation, and it very helpful to me, and I'm sure to all the other callers. And I will be happy to, at some point, post this onto the Addiction Psychology website. I want to say I will send out a link to this. There were a number of people who requested the slides, and I couldn't get to everybody in time. But if you're not on the distribution list, please email me, drmarkshenker@gmail.com, and I will put you on the distribution list where you will get the slides automatically. So
and also,
again.
I'll load them up today, Mark. Even without the call, I think I can create the framework for the conference call on addictionpsychology.org.
Okay.
Excuse me, Mark. I just want to let you know I am on that distribution list, and I did not get the slides originally.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, send me an email again.
You just sent it to me, so thank you. But I just wanted you to know it didn't come originally.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sorry about that.
I know. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you, Katie.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone, for joining on.
Thanks,
Katie. Awesome.
Great information. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Katie.
So it's okay to use these slides with clients. I mean, I can put your credit to you at the bottom, but I think that would be really wonderful.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've never. We don't do a lot of that. We really mm-hmm. focus on making it more experiential.
Mm-hmm.
But to the extent that you could kind of do the exercise and then show them the slides, I think that would be effective.
Yes, I find it sometimes with some folks it helps in terms of, you know, both conceptualizing or visualizing it and, oh, okay, so this is. I see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Thanks again, Katie. It was wonderful.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. I hope the pace was okay.
it was just right.
Excellent. All right. Thank
you.
Yeah,
just exactly on time. Thank you.
Great.
Thanks, Katie.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Katie.